ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Oh, what's this? No, another compulsory online training course that I have to do. 235 days overdue? Oh, even if you love learning, why is it that sometimes workplace learning can feel like a chore? Hello, I'm Lisa Leong for ABC Radio National's This Working Life, helping to make your work life better. Workplace learning often gets a bad rap, doesn't it? In this episode, we're going to learn how to make it more fascinating and memorable, in a good way, I promise. Ryan Jessen is a cognitive scientist in the School of Psychology at the University of Queensland. Hello, Ryan.
G'day.
What's going on in our brains when we're trying to learn at work?
What's going on in our brains when we're learning at work is the same thing that's going on in our brains when we're learning everywhere, which is that fundamentally we're trying to form new memories, hopefully memories that stick.
And why is it that it's so hard to create these memories and remember things that we've learned in workplace training courses later on?
Because our memory is geared for efficiency. So it kind of has this inbuilt system of essentially flagging what's worth remembering. So what's important to us are the things that we hold onto. So one of the ways that our mind flags what's important is by paying attention to how frequently we see something. So you can imagine that if you've got to do your annual fire safety training that you do once a year, because you're only encountering that very infrequently, we don't necessarily hold on to that information because it's not marked as important. We are excellent at recognizing patterns. So this pattern recognition machinery is kind of the thing that is motivating this importance flagging. It's worth holding on to things that we encounter commonly so that we are prepared to deal with them the next time we encounter them. But of course, if we simply see something once or twice, those are the things that we tend to forget.
Ryan, you heard me groan about those self-directed online training courses just a minute ago. And it's definitely not about the quality of them, because some of them are quite interactive and they're amazing. What's your take?
Yeah, well, look, online learning can be as effective as any other form of delivery if it's designed well. So we've learned a lot in the science of learning about the techniques that lead to this kind of learning that sticks. And if those techniques are applied, whether it's online or in a classroom setting or in a workshop, then that learning is still going to stick. What tends to happen a lot of the time with online learning, though, is that they're not always designed with those strategies in mind. So often when we're kind of engaging in online learning, it might look like something like watching a couple of short videos and doing a relatively easy multiple choice question at the end of those videos. And the reason it's not going to stick again is because we're only kind of doing it once, but we're also really not engaging in an active process. So watching videos feels easy. It's the information feels like it's kind of going down or washing over us nice and easily. But the key is that with learning that really sticks, we need to actually be recalling that information from our memory, because that's the thing that actually strengthens those memories in the first place. So rather than responding to a couple of easy multiple choice questions, a better option would be to engage in, say, you know, questions that ask you to, right, tell me about a new example now where you can apply this thing that you've learned in your own life, relating it to things that we already know and really stretching us, making us effortfully engage or recall what we've just learned.
Ryan, give us another example of how self-directed online learning courses could be improved, maybe in the body of it. And you can use cybersecurity as an example, perhaps.
The goal is to design not only information that closely resembles the challenge that we're actually dealing with, but to design practice tests and activities that get you actively working on that problem too. So rather than telling me about, you know, here are the signs to look out for phishing emails. Yep, sure. Tell me about the information. Now, give me a scenario. In fact, give me an actual list of emails. Make me have to look out for what are the emails here that look fishy to me. I have to do the process itself and then give me feedback about how I went and crucially, make me do this kind of challenge again in a week, in a month, in 2 months, because when we return to that learning process and we space out our learning, that's the real thing that's going to powerfully make sure it sticks in our mind.
Now, I don't want to pick on online learning courses because, Ryan, as you said, it's less about the channel and more about our approach to it. So let's go now to a day workshop in a group. It's facilitated. There'll be sure. expert guests and I'm being taught specific skills. I might have felt like I've learnt a lot in that day, but Ryan, have I actually?
One of the things that the science of learning has taught us, maybe one of my favourite fun facts, is that our intuitions about learning can be way off about with respect to what's actually going on for us. So if you think about that feeling that you have at the end of a workshop where you've had a presenter in front of you who has presented this beautifully curated set of information. Often they've used visuals to go on their slides and everything that they've explained is beautifully structured. And as you sit in the audience, it feels like this information is kind of just washing over you. Everything makes sense and you can easily comprehend and follow along with what they're saying. This feeling is what we call fluency. But fluency, so this feeling of easiness of information processing, can actually kind of trick us into feeling like we've learned something because the ease with which information goes down is not a cue for how well we're actually going to retain that information later on, which can be a bit of a trap because if we are only using this cue of fluency to kind of judge how much we've learned something, well, then we might be less likely to actually go back and revisit that content because chances are if a colleague asks you the next day, hey, could you tell me about this part of the workshop yesterday? You might find that there's very little you've actually held on to.
Okay, on LinkedIn, I asked, what helps you learn new skills and information at work? And Dara responded with this.
When we think about the skills that we need right now to navigate this rapid pace of change with technology, soft is the new hard. Hard skills now are those human skills around adaptability, empathy, curiosity, imagination, trust, psychological safety. The best way we can learn this is through play. It builds new neural pathways. It helps us try and fail and experiment. Literally, play is one of the best ways we can learn.
Ryan, is using play a good way to make learning stick?
I think it absolutely can be. You may well have all of the technical strategies in your tool belt, retrieval practice and spacing and that kind of thing. But if you're not motivated to engage in those strategies in the first place, well, they're not much use to you. If play makes something enjoyable to you and you're motivated to engage in those strategies, then you're already off to a cracking start. If play also means that as you engage in the task itself that you're aiming to get better at, you experience a sense of pleasure because you kind of get that reward as you make progress, a gamification kind of thing. Again, that's going to keep motivating you, pressing you forward. And if that play scenario resembles very closely what you're actually gearing towards improving at. So if my goal is to get really good at, I don't know, using Excel formulas in my spreadsheets, and I can create a game that, you know, makes me have to kind of identify or use the right one and I get points, then that would be an excellent use of that kind of strategy as well. So I think, yeah, totally, play can be an awesome way to learn things.
I'd like to introduce you now to Michelle Ockers, who's founder and chief learning strategist at Learning Uncut. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, Lisa. It's lovely to be here.
Why do organisations invest in learning and development for their staff, Michelle?
We're all human, right? To learn is one of the most natural things we do as humans from the day we're born. We never actually stop. But the role of L&D in organisations, the reason we're invested in, is to make that more effective and pointed at the right things. It's really to help build workforce capability, to keep organisations compliant with regulations, which is your licence to operate, to drive performance and to stay competitive when things change. So equipping people to perform their job today and helping them to be ready for tomorrow. And Dara touched on the rapid change we're now facing and this important role of L&D to help people to be able to adapt to change, to learn new skills, even when a training course isn't available, Lisa.
Mm. Say more about that.
So the difference between workplace learning and training. Training is one of the ways. We've been talking about courses, be they workshops or online e-learning modules. That's formal structured learning. That's training. Workplace learning is a lot broader. And Dara touched on it to some degree when she spoke about play and she used the word experiment. If we are back in the workplace, even after a course, Ryan talked about this spaced repetition and recall and using information. If we don't use it, we lose it. So it's about practicing while we're working, trying new things out while we're working, solving problems on the job, learning from colleagues, maybe coaching and mentoring. So it's much broader than just sitting in classrooms and doing online courses. And if we can build people's skills and create an environment in the workplace where people can continue to learn from their work, with each other and with the support of their managers, then it's so much more effective than just relying on courses.
Michelle, there's a concept in learning and development called the 70-20-10 rule. Can you tell us what this is?
Yeah, this was a framework that came from some research back in the 1980s. A group called the Centre for Creative Leadership interviewed successful executives and they asked them where they'd learned their most important lessons in their career. What they found from this research was roughly 70% came from on-the-job experience and challenges, 20% from relationships with other people and learning from others, and about 10% from these formal training and courses. However, beyond this first study, there's little evidence to actually back up the numbers. So here's the important thing. It's not about percentages. The real value of this 70-20-10 model is that it reminds us that learning happens in lots of different ways and much of it through experience and other people, not just in the classroom and online modules. So, and as we spoke about before, a graduate might need more of the 10, the courses. A more experienced technical expert might need more about trying things out, learning from other people. But the core insight holds. We've really started dropping that 70-20-10 language because it creates so much confusion. These days, we talk more about experience, education, and exposure. And the Australian Public Service, I think, has cracked this absolutely with really plain language. They talk about learning happening through courses, resources, your work, and other people. So simple.
And what does the evidence actually show about the best methods for learning at work?
There's stacks of really good quality evidence from learning science, behavioural science around behaviour change, cognitive psychology. But the tricky bit, Lisa, is that L&D is a really porous profession, and I'm using air quotes. People can move in and out of L&D all the time. And often people come in without any background, any education in learning science. So we go to the stuff that feels intuitively right, like this idea of learning styles, thoroughly debunked, but we hang on to it. Or we look at technology as our saviour. So we can scale things with tech. Let's just throw everything on tech and the job's done. But good L&D professionals are getting better at asking, what's the evidence for this before jumping on any bandwagons? There's some great, what I call research translators who take the academic research in the way Ryan just did so beautifully and break it down in plain language to explain how we can actually apply it in our work.
And just a point, when you say L&D, that's learning and development for people
who... Yeah, sorry, sure, a bit of jargon there, learning and development.
You're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National. I'm Lisa Leong, and I'm speaking with cognitive scientist Ryan Jessen and learning and development consultant Michelle Ockers. You were talking about the best methods for learning at work. Do you want to give us an example, if you can, on what you mean by behavioural science being helpful for learning?
Yeah, there's something that we've picked up from behavioural science and has been used a lot, and it's called nudge theory. And the idea of nudge theory is that we can nudge behaviours by creating an environment which makes it easy for people to do the right thing, to apply new behaviours, and harder for them to do the wrong thing. But what this might look like is an app on your phone. After you've done a training course, you get periodically, maybe the day after the training course, a little snippet to remind you of something and a suggestion for how you might apply that in your work or a question. A week later, you get something else. Maybe 2 weeks later, you get something else and a suggestion, you discuss it with somebody else or you reflect on how that worked out for you. That's an example of taking something from behavioural science.
Ryan, can you tell me about simulations and why this helps learning at work?
Absolutely. So one thing that we do know about learning is that transfer is very narrow. So what I mean by transfer is being able to take our learning that we've gained in one particular context and apply it to another context, which means if I want to get really good at tennis, playing a lot of ping pong is not going to help me, right? So that's not going to transfer into that other domain. So the more we can actually build our learning context to closely as possible resemble our actual application context, so where we actually use those skills, the better. If my goal is to become really competent using the phones at a customer service kind of role, the more practice I can get in with actually dealing with disgruntled customers or multitasking, you know, simulation exercises that build those scenarios in, the better I'm actually going to transfer my learning when I'm actually encountered by that disgruntled customer.
Michelle, do you have an example of a simulation?
I do, and this is an interesting one in the domain of AI, right? It's really hard to get enough practice in situations which are hard to replicate in a simulation. But what AI can help us to do, and there's quite a few examples of this, is to set up conversational and system practice environments to rehearse those hard or tricky or unusual and infrequent customer interactions and conversations. So that's something that increasingly we're seeing contact centres in large organisations implementing and using.
Michelle, how important is the role of manager in facilitating or supporting learning at work?
Absolutely critical. And there is some evidence to suggest it's even more important than the work that the learning and development team does in some ways, in that managers are there every day. They're the ones who can create stretch assignments to give people challenging work, to give them a chance to practice, to provide opportunities for feedback, maybe connect them with someone more experienced who can coach them on the job. They're also role modelling, whether they realise it or not. And a good manager creates an environment where it's safe to try things and maybe make a mistake where the stakes are low and learn from that. They get the team together to reflect on how they're working, how they're performing, what people are learning, what they're going to try next. So they can create an opportunity for team learning in the context of the work as well as individual learning.
Michelle, building on that, often you get sort of taken out of your regular role for a short period of time to do this learning and then you go straight back into the role. What impact does this have on the learning?
It depends if you're given an opportunity to apply and embed. That's the key thing. You've got to be given that opportunity to practice and to get feedback. There's something called the forgetting curve. You actually lose stuff because you haven't formed strong enough pathways in your brain to just repeat things and recall it. The frequency effect that Ryan talked about earlier, you've got to be given the opportunity to use what you've learned, to practice, to recall and work with it. So if people are being sent on courses to do things that they have no opportunity to apply in their job, like, it's kind of irrelevant. Timing is really important.
Ryan, in your experience, what's the future role then of AI in workplace learning?
If we only use those tools as a essentially answer provider, then in terms of what they can do for learning, you know, not much at all. However, these kind of foundational models, so the companies like OpenAI and Anthropic and so on, they're already releasing models that are actually geared towards learning, which means that their back-end kind of instructions have been injected with the exact kind of principles that we've been talking about. So the things that get you actively recalling, practice testing, and those sort of things. You can use those baseline models even yourself as long as you tell the model, hey, here's the thing that I want to learn. Even better, if you've got a manual or protocol document that you actually really need to get across, if you actually feed that into the model itself and say, right, here's your knowledge base and you're going to help me learn this. The way that you're going to do that, though, is that you're going to ask me questions. Then you can have actually a conversation. It doesn't have to feel so much like a formal quiz or a test, because the huge benefit that these chatbots essentially have is that they're able to meet you at your individual level. So you can provide an answer, and then rather than coming back and immediately saying, yeah, that was right or wrong, the model can see exactly where your own gaps in your knowledge are and poke you a little bit further. Hey, could you elaborate on this point? You're almost there, but what about this little thing that you haven't quite spoken about? Again, it's getting more of that active recall process happening. You're effortfully engaging with that material. And so by injecting that kind of individual level of feedback into a conversation that has all the right ingredients for making things stick, potentially you have an extremely powerful learning tool at your fingertips.
Michelle, my mind is racing with possibilities here. Could AI end up doing the coaching and teaching in workplaces at a personalised or individual level?
It can do it for knowledge. And, you know, that process Ryan just spoke about, that's something that L&D teams are starting to do and need to do more of. But when you think about it, if you're working with physical skills, and I've done a lot of work, for instance, in manufacturing environments, AI can't watch you perform a task on the production line and give you feedback on that. So there's still a role for people to do that. I think it's very much a partnership. We often hear about this idea of humans and AIs working together. I think it's a great example of how you might put the two together to build up both knowledge and skills.
Each week, we ask guests to give our listeners a tip that they can try in their own working lives. It's called Try This. Ryan, what tip would you give to make sure that what I'm learning sticks?
If I feel like I'm sitting back, things are washing over me, then probably not much learning is happening. So if it doesn't feel hard, you're not learning. And like Michelle said, the more that we actively use the knowledge, so pulling that knowledge back out of our memories rather than purely focusing on putting stuff in.
Michelle, then on an individual level, what can I do to keep my skills and knowledge relevant?
Understand what skills are needed in your organisation and what's important. So part of this is about if it's not clear, going out and finding what's available, asking your manager, asking HR, asking L&D, go to your learning platform. And most organisations have a learning platform. You may never have opened it other than to do your compliance training, but find out what's available. Is there coaching available, mentoring available? What skills are important? And if there's a job you're interested in developing into the future, what skills are needed for that? And then make it known that you'd like access to those opportunities, or find other people who are already good in those skills and connect with them. Ask them about what's driven their skill development, what tips do they have for you to develop those skills. Practice and get feedback from those who are already good at the skills that your organisation is valuing or that are going to be needed for your next job or for your future career development.
Thanks both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michelle Ockers is the founder and chief learning strategist at Learning Uncut, and Ryan Jessen is a cognitive scientist in the School of Psychology at the University of Queensland. Our story about the early warning signs of burnout prompted a This Week in Lifer to send a voice memo.
Hello, this is Amanda sharing my experience of burnout. I'm in my early 50s and have had a very successful and demanding career in corporate world, working for multinationals based out of Australia here, and I have two young children who are now in high school. Burnout kind of hit me big, I think, about a year and a half ago. My father passed away after a short illness at the end of 2022, kind of out of the blue, it sort of happened. And at the same time, I think I was very stretched professionally. I actually remember hearing a story on the radio about a very high percentage of women who had a big career disruption during the menopause years. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm going to be able to hold it together. But lo and behold, I didn't. Many, you know, years of working across time zones, caregiving, being a parent, being a partner, being a child, a sibling, and trying to hold it all together, I really, you know, took about 2 or 3 years for me to really hit rock bottom, which I did in 2024. And this year has been about rebuilding. So I just wanted to share my story to say it can happen. It's okay. You can get past it, but it requires some really deep searching and really reconnecting to your values and prioritizing what's important.
Thank you, Amanda. I'm glad you're on the road to recovery. You can hear our episode, Are You on the Path to Burnout? These are the red flags, on the ABC Listen app or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And we just love hearing your perspective and stories, so please do send them through. You can record a voice memo on your phone like Amanda did and email it to us at thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Thanks for listening to ABC Radio National's This Working Life. It was produced by Michelle Weeks and engineered by Tim James on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. If you like what you heard, subscribe to our podcast, share it with a colleague or a friend. You can do that on the ABC Listen app or anywhere you listen to podcasts. I'm Lisa Leong. Until next time, work it, baby.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.